I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Later in the hour, we talk with a Palestinian refugee about exiled Palestinians, many who have lived their entire lives in refugee camps. And we'll hear a story about raising pigeons in one of the world's most dangerous cities. But first, Joan Burston is an educator and poet. She was born and raised in England. Born in 1929, she was a child when World War II began. She recently gave two talks in Falmouth about the impacts of war. You were 10 years old when World War II began. Tell us a little bit about what life was like for you before the war started.
As if I can remember much about it before the war, except that I can tell you from some of the pictures that I've got that I used in the presentation that we used to go in the summer for about 2 weeks and rent a house in Worthing, which was on the south coast of England. And we went with my mother's family, many members of whom would rent houses there too. And my grandmother would sort of sit in the middle of her grandchildren and her children on the beach. And she always wore her everyday clothes. We've got a photograph of her, which I haven't used, just sitting on the beach with her regular skirt and long skirt and sitting on there and with the children. But she had 10 children. And my mother's family was very close. We used to go down to the beach and spend our time. It wasn't a beach, even like Stony Beach, we call Stony Beach, but you really don't know what a stony beach is like unless you've been to some of these beaches in England on the south coast, which are very pebbly. And I used to depend on an uncle who would dig big holes in the rocks and in the sand. And we needed him to be able to do that. And he used to wear a kind of oil that he put on himself to prevent his sun from baking his back. And it used to attract wasps. And used to have to stay a long way away from him as he was digging. And he got the wasps around him. Mm.
So from what you remember before the war, you had a happy childhood. Things were good.
Yes, but I do know that my family, all because we were Jewish, already knew a lot about what was going on in Germany. And I knew this for two reasons that actually impacted me. One was that my father had a man who worked for him in his office, and he had come from Germany and had, in the First World War, been a German soldier and had been very proud of the part he had played in the First World War, and he had won a big medal. I believe it was the Iron Cross, but I may have made that part up, but that was what I recall. And he was absolutely dismayed that he had been driven out of Germany and was fearing for his life and for the life of his relatives. And trying to make sense of that was such that he would come to see us at times and talk about it. And I know I was in on the outskirts listening to this kind of talk that was going on. The other thing that was that we knew, because we had cousins who were in Germany, cousins of my father's, and maybe second cousins, and they had already sent two of their sons over to England. And we knew from them as to how bad things were, and they indeed never saw their parents again. Oh.
Now, as the war began, tell us about those first months. Children were evacuated from central London. What was going on? And what was going on in your mind as the war began?
As far as I was concerned, I was sent away with my school. Now, my school was in the outskirts of London. We were not right in the center, so I can't pretend that we were right in the very center of things. We were living in the northwest in Mill Hill, and we were close to an airfield, which was the airfield used by the hurricane fighters. So that did make us more likely to receive bombing than some of the other areas on the outskirts of London. But my parents felt that I should be out of London. My brother's 5 years older than myself, and he was 15. And so they didn't think of sending him away, but they thought of sending me away with the school. And the school voluntarily evacuated to the west of England, which was much more out of reach of the Germans. And we I went with them. But when I got there, I wasn't very happy. My parents sent me a letter and said, you know, are you happy? And I said, no, I'm not. And so then they got in the car before car rationing, gasoline rationing, and they came and they picked me up. And they brought me home. And when they brought me home, they made a decision. They did not want me to stay in London because things sounded so unsure of what was going to happen. So they chose a school on the south coast facing France, which, of course, was an ally of Britain and therefore looked very safe to them. And I went there for several months. And that's where I was when the Germans invaded Holland and Belgium, and then France.
Now, what were your thoughts? I mean, I'm thinking back to when I was maybe a little bit older than 10, but thereabouts, when we had the Cold War, and we were all afraid of a nuclear bomb. And, you know, you heard all this stuff about bomb shelters, and we had these silly exercises in school where we had to get under the desks, like that would save us. And I remember that fear. Did you feel that kind of fear at this time?
Oh, yes, of course, because we had to have gas masks immediately, and we had to go and get them fitted, and you had to have them with you. When I was back in London in 1940, then that feeling was tremendously with you all the time. I mean, there were two sort of ways in which I can remember it particularly. I remember that we always took our gas mask with us. We put it on and tried it on at different times. I remember in the 1940 era, that 40-41, that we would be collecting shrapnel every morning, because when the Germans came over during the night with the airplanes, there would be enormous amount of anti-aircraft guns that were firing, and it was a big thing for us to collect pieces of shrapnel on the ground as we walked to school, because you could sort of, you know, you could trade your shrapnel with your friends, or at least look at it and see who'd got the biggest piece of shrapnel and what it was like. So that was always with us.
Yeah. At one point, your mother suggests that you join three cousins and an aunt who were leaving Britain for Canada, but you refused. You said that you would rather die with your family than become an orphan.
I found it interesting that I put that in, because I can remember this discussion that we had, that I should go with my cousins. My cousins had an aunt who lived in Montreal, and they were going to go over there, the three of them, with their mother and stay there, which they did until later in the war when they came back. But my father and mother at least tried out the idea that they would send me. I don't know whether they would have been able to find the money to do it or how it would have been done, but I was determined not to go. I was very frightened about being an orphan, and I started thinking about why that might be. Part of it was that there were a lot of stories we read when we were young about children who were orphans, but also I had two cousins whose parents died when they were very young. My woman cousin, who was just a little bit older than me, she was three when her parents died, and her brother was about 3 years older. And the children got divided among different family members. And another cousin also, both his parents died. So I knew about what it was like to be a member of our family who didn't have a father and a mother. And I was a child who imagined all kinds of things.
I was thinking, though, of your mother, thinking, you know, at 10 years old, or it was, we were a little bit older than that, I guess, at the time, but it's like that you were allowed to even be part of that decision.
Well, it is interesting that I was listening to us discussing things this summer in front of my 10-year-old, just turned 11-year-old grandson. And I saw him trying to join in the conversation and be part of it, and being very aggravated that he wasn't allowed to be part of it. And I think that what we did was listen. You, as a child, and in Britain we were taught that you didn't really join in the adults' discussions, but you spend a lot of time hearing what they were talking about, and you knew an awful lot. And by the time it came to the German invasion threat in 1940, I knew that I would have to fight to prevent myself from being captured by a German soldier, and I didn't have much of an idea that it wouldn't happen. I just sort of decided I was going to fight.
So in August 1940, Germans begin the raids over London. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, that was exacerbated in my family in a way because my father had been unable to, I'm putting this in a strange way, my father had decided that he would assist the government in order to be able to sell goods abroad because we needed, the British government needed, lend-lease and money to purchase arms from America. And America was not joining in the war in Europe. It was not part of the war of Europe. That was a war that was over there, and we over here were not going to be involved with it. And so the result of that was that my father took off on, I think it was the 24th of August, and left the country. And I didn't even know until he came back and years later told us about the experiences that he had doing that, because when he left, he got on a boat, and the boat was filled with women and children going over to Canada or America. And they men had then had exercises every day on the boat as to what was going to happen if the boat was torpedoed. And he said they knew from the beginning that there weren't enough lifeboats, and the women and children were going first, and the men knew they wouldn't be saved. And it's like amazing to hear his story about that. But anyway, he took off and went across the Atlantic in August and left us at home. And at that point, my mother and her mother and an aunt and an uncle came to stay with us in our house. I think probably because they were living in the center of London and they really were going to be clobbered with the attacks, but also because they felt that it was a family holding together and they wanted to help her while she coped with this.
War is something that you never forget. So how do you think that's impacted your life?
Oh, enormously. It has made me not see war in any way from the perspective that I hear about it so often. There are so many people who feel that they can somehow or another act in a way that's going to be noble. And we pay honor, and rightfully so, to those people who have fought for their country. But the people who are at the receiving end are fighting for their country too. And I think what I wanted to do in putting this together was to speak about the horror of war from the perspective of a child who became very articulate by the time she was 15, 14 and 15, writing in her diary, but realizing that war is abominable for the tensions that it places on the civilians. And what I wanted to show in the talk that I gave was how the number of civilians involved with war became greater as the war continued, because the weaponry became much more sophisticated and broadly effective as it was dealing with the civilian population. And by the time you reach the point of having the atomic bomb, you realize you can wipe out a whole city. Mm. And these are individuals who are just sitting targets. And what you're trying to do is to maximize the security of the people who are using the weapons. That is to say, you don't lose as many men, and it's usually men in those days, who are fighting on your side, if you can be in an airplane up above, or even if you can send a pilotless or a rocket. Mm-hmm. And what has happened in the Second World War was the development of the machinery for being able to deliver weapons without in any way affecting your own populations, whoever the you are.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be, you may feel you've got a righteous cause, but you and your community are apparently not going to be affected by the weapon that drops somewhere.
Mm. I'm wondering your thoughts on, and when you gave two talks about this, yes. And I'm thinking, you know, we're thinking of a younger generation that doesn't remember the Vietnam War, never mind World War II, and the horrors of that. What was the reaction of the audience? Did you have any younger folks who attended this, or was it mostly, you know, older folks?
Well, it was interesting to me, in Woods Hole here at the library, there were the grandchildren of our friends Andy and Lynn Leese, who are professors themselves, professors of history. And their granddaughters came from England, and they were sitting in on the discussion in the library. I think one was in her early teens and one a little younger. And they had been learning about World War II in England, apparently, and they were apparently very interested in hearing it. Then there was another group, my grandson, who is his late 20s. He brought a lot of his friends from Woods Hole, and they've said to me, oh, they appreciated it. And then one of them has a friend who's from Australia, and then I talked about the way the British Commonwealth had pulled together at the time, and he was interested in that. So there were people of many ages. And then in the audience here in the library, there was a gentleman who came up and spoke to me at the end, and he had lived in Bourne, and he had only heard about it from a friend who knew there was something going on in Woods Hole that evening about World War II, and he had been in the north of England at the time. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, there were people, I think, I don't know, of course, how people responded in terms of what it means to them. But I do know that 2 weeks later, when I gave the talk in the Falmouth Jewish congregation, the understanding of the significance of the changes that led to the use of atomic weapons and what this means for society if we were to see a war using them had begun to seep into
it. It seems we were, you know, kind of thinking that, you know, this nuclear war would not happen. And now there's been some tensions that have got people thinking about it again and being fearful. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are that we need to be very careful about the ways in which we approach this issue, because we have managed for 60 years almost now, since the end of the war, maybe it was longer than 60 years, to at least come to an understanding that we cannot stop various nations from obtaining nuclear capabilities. But at the same time, we can learn how to at least constrain ourselves in the use of those weapons. And you see, for example, India and Pakistan, who in many situations over the years might have been tempted to use them. You see it in relation to Pakistan and other Muslim nations in relation to the possibility that Israel has nuclear weapons. You see it in the constraints that John F. Kennedy had in the 1960s against the Soviet Union. If you start rattling the war threat, it seems to me that you are asking for trouble if you don't go that direction. The problem is that you've got two threats that I can see. One is that you would have a nation that is determined to protect itself because it becomes so fearful that it's going to use the weaponry. And another is that you have a rogue non-nation managing to obtain the weapons that exist in some places that have them. Yeah.
The war ended in 1945. Where were you when you learned about the end of the war? Do you remember hearing that news?
I was at home in London, so far as I know, and we sort of expected that which war are you talking about?
I'm talking World War II.
Well, but yeah. I'm talking about the end of the war in Europe. Mm-hmm. The end of the war, when it came in August of when it came to the end after the dropping on the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were very different for us, because the war in Europe was the thing that was immediately affecting us, and it ended on May the 8th. And I was at home in London, and we were just so overjoyed, and we went into London there afterwards, which I talked about from my diary. We went up to the centre of London. We went and walked to see if we could see the King and Queen, and we stood outside Buckingham Palace, and they had just come out, and we missed them. We went to see the Prime Minister at 10 Downing Street, and he was outside, and he must have been a microphone in front of him. We heard him. I mean, it was just an enormous sense of rejoicing.
How did you?
Afterwards, my brother, who was then 20, was in his 20s, went into the centre of London in the evening for the festivities, but I wasn't allowed to or didn't go into that, so I didn't get involved with the final
How did your ideas about war and peace change between that 1939 and 1945?
Well, that was something where I do have a poem that I used for the talk, which is called Victory Verses, that I wrote about my idea. And this is the point. I thought that war was going to end, and that was going to be really the end of war. It was strange, because I was a student of history even in those early days, and how I came to the notion that we could end war, I'm not quite sure. But what happened was that between 1944 and 45, I became enormously disillusioned. And realized as it came to the end of the war, and I was writing notes in my diary at that time, that all of a sudden there's fighting going on in Greece between the communists and the non-communists. There's fighting with Chiang Kai-shek and the Soviet Union. Everybody seems to want to go on fighting. And it was like, it was such a letdown, such a despair that came over me, which might have been partly, you know, we would say now might be PTSD. I mean, it was obviously that the doodlebugs and the rockets were something that had shaken me enormously. And for about 6 years after the war, I was incredibly depressed. And really writing poetry that said, you know, we daren't look for the future. We daren't look at what's going to go on beyond, because we just can't take it. And then I guess I began to realize that I couldn't go on like that all the time, and had to do something about it. But even so, I do have one poem here, which is the one on this, coming to the moment when there's the war between Iran and Iraq. And it was as though you just feel as though everywhere you turn, there's been warfare, and there's been sirens somewhere in the world, and it has been, and that was very disheartening, I guess, for me in a way. And I'm going to read you a poem which is different, and it's called "Funeral in Ireland," if I may. Mm-hmm. But it does pick out something of my thoughts about this, and this is May the 13th, 1981. And remember, the war between Iraq and Iran began in 1980, and the funeral in Ireland is the fighting between Northern Irish and the Southern Irish. Voices keening in hate, bitter gall spat on coffins, vengeance spelled in lives of men, stubborn as mules, rock firm to death. Ripped from families like torn limbs, men martyred and mourned. And somewhere, their torn families, bedraggled refugees, searching among the shards of desolation.
How does the writing of the poetry, does that help you deal with some of these memories and some of the thoughts you have about war?
I think it must do, otherwise I don't think I would write it. I think that's true. I mean, I think I do. I use the poems as a way of coping. And coping with the sorrow of just seeing what humans do to one another. Mm. And thinking now of, you know, 65 million people apparently who are refugees in some way in the world. And we have, I drive through the countryside here and I look at it and I think, and we don't have any space for any people. And then I think of the turmoil when you do have many people from many different groups together and the effort it takes us to forge ourselves into a community always. But that's the nature of life. That's what you have to do. You have to open yourself up in order to be able to create a new whole. Mm. So I guess that's my thought on it. Mm.
Joan Burston, thanks so much for sharing your stories with us and the talks that you did. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up after a break, life for exiled Palestinians living in refugee camps.